Good evening. The time is 6:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Bread and Roses. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression, all this, and we have fun. I'm your host tonight, Cheryl Green. Our engineer is Tom. Tonight, you'll be hearing a rebroadcast from my own podcast. My guest tonight is Vilissa Thompson, who's the digital manager for Rooted in Rights in Washington State, the place that produces my absolute favorite disability rights video content and more. That job is only one piece of her career pie. I'm going to turn it over to Vilissa to tell you more.
Well, my name is Vilissa Thompson, and I am from Winsboro, South Carolina. I am a social worker, consultant, writer, advocate, speaker, who has created the platform Rap Your Voice. It'll be 4 years old in July. It's a space where I blog and talk about my experiences as a Black disabled woman and share my educational and personal backgrounds in a way that's intersectional. You know, when I started blogging, 5 years ago, really wasn't visible. I am as I said, a disabled person. I have a brittle bone condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, and I'm also hard of hearing. I wear hearing aids. I'm also a wheelchair user and a little woman. Those are my disabilities. I'm proudly disabled and politically disabled, as I really am deeply involved within the disability rights movement with the work that I do with Rap Your Voice and the services that I provide, the advocacy that I do relentlessly and unapologetically every day. And I'm also 31 years old. I'm a millennial. And this is who I am.
I am so glad that you said relentlessly and unapologetically. So I'm white, and I see people, friends or not friends, just online or in real life, constantly saying, I like your message, but if you could just say it more politely and really, you know, put it in a way that I can hear it. And I don't think that that's a fair demand to make on top of everything else. So thank you for being relentless and unapologetic.
You know, that type of message, I see it more so done towards women. Society wants women to be quiet, you know, to be docile, to be easily controlled, you know. So when particularly women, and then you add that other intersections as being of color and being disabled, when you are, you know, fierce in your message, the reaction to that is trying to silence or try to dismiss what you're trying to say and the word that you're, you know, hoping to achieve. So for me, it is, you know, a very frustrating and also disrespectful approach to give advocates or to give to anybody who just speaking fearlessly about the issues that matter to them and trying to really control the message out there. We really don't need that type of censorship with everything that's going on around us each day. You know, so I really, you know, when I see that happening, not just to myself, but to other, particularly other women and other marginalized voices, you know, it just really shows the resistance to hearing the truth and to really accepting people's ability to advocate and support and to vocalize what matters to them.
You, in addition to your blog and your other online work, you're getting published, featured, and interviewed discussing disability from an intersectional lens in all sorts of non-disability spaces and disability. Mm-hmm. Huffington Post, New York Times, BuzzFeed, Bitch Media, Upworthy, Black Girl Nerds, No Totally, Just Add Color, Accessible Media Inc., Daily Dot, Daily Beast, and The Atlantic. That's probably just a partial list, but it is a beautiful list. Do you ever find from some of these non-disability specific media outlets that they hesitate to publish your work or they struggle with your intersectional disability lens?
What I find is that a lot of those outlets that you mentioned are looking for disabled voices because disability is not an identity that is widely discussed. And if it is, it's usually not by us as disabled people. Usually those who have I call it eyewitness understanding, such as parents, teachers, caregivers. So I really find it, you know, impressive and fortunate that these particularly non-disabled outlets really seek out diverse disabled voices. I don't mind being a disabled voice in a space that doesn't talk about disability every day. What I've encountered is that these, you know, these hosts, you know, these writers, you know, these podcasters, you know, who have these platforms, they really want to ensure that if they're going to have a discussion about disability, it comes from an authentic place. And they really respect the voices that they, you know, are able to get on their platforms. So I really feel that, you know, they focus on disability and getting actually disabled people to discuss, you know, our plight in a way that doesn't typically get attention, you know, shows that intersectionality and inclusion is a priority for those particular platforms. So I really enjoy, you know, being on non-disabled platforms to either share about my work, share my story, talk about any particular issues such as education or politics. I really enjoy doing that because it allows their audiences to learn about a perspective they normally would not hear about. And also depends on the topic, empowering myself and other disabled people who may be listeners or readers to their mediums, you know, to really have a new understanding on a very underrepresented identity.
I am so glad to hear that it's such a positive experience. I think from my question, you can probably tell what a cynical kind of grumpy person I am. Like,
I think that, you know, there is always room for certain spaces to not be, you know, a positive experience. But luckily for me, I have not had that experience. What I've found is that some of the writers or podcasters or interviewers, they either know about disability, you know, on a general sense, or they may not know much at all, but they're open to learning. I've been able to find some very open-minded, very positive thinking and pretty great and rad people to really interact with. But I do know that not every platform presents disability, even if you have the best voices in the movement in a way that is empowering or is appropriate. So I know that I've been very selective as to what platforms I do give my voice to or allow my work to be on to make sure that it's not manipulated in a way that's harmful to the movement or misrepresents what I stand for.
People don't always tend to recognize that most of the disabled voices out there are from white people, and people of color, mm-hmm. and black people are, I think, quite deliberately silenced. And I'm going to link to some specific examples from Twitter and Storify. You started this campaign, hashtag Disability2White, in May of 2016. This is your hashtagversary. Talk me through what led you to create and launch that campaign.
It was kind of funny. Our mutual friend, Alice Wong, had posted an article from XO Jane that discussed disability and beauty. And it featured disabled women, but they featured white disabled women. And usually when I see articles, you know, about beauty and disability, it is usually from white disabled women. And so Alice and a few other advocates were talking about the article, how it's the same old, same old. And I joined in on a conversation on Twitter. And while I was tweeting, the hashtag just kind of came to my mind. And it synthesized what we were all were talking about, you know, disability being too white, you know, just one monolithic view that is inaccurate. So I started using the hashtag in my tweets, and it just took from there. Other people started using it, just created this firestorm in a way that had over 13,000 tweets in less than 24 hours. And it just took a life of its own to really, you know, bust the door wide open for this conversation to be had publicly. You know, this issue, you know, has been the elephant in the room for the community for so long. When you look at disability history, you look at the images that you find online, look at the stories that you see, you know, they are typically white disabled people. And if they are of color, they're usually showing us in lights to where we look very impoverished or just very frail and, you know, not really being as vibrant as some white disabled people when their stories are being told. You know, we don't have diverse leadership. We don't, you know, support the voices and work of disabled people of color as we should. Our history lays out the experiences and lives of white leadership and not those of color. So, you know, our movement has been for far too long projecting this one image of disability that ignores, and like you said, deliberately at times, the contributions, the experiences, the disparities that affect disabled people of color. And so I feel that this hashtag has allowed that conversation to be had, and people really gravitated towards that and really share their stories in ways that I don't believe they would have without such a prominent hashtag like that. So that what really made me proud of it, that people really told their truths and the realities of what we're going through in this community as people of color. And the racism, the erasure, the exclusion, the lack of representation, the invisibility, all of that impacts how we view ourselves as people, how we view ourselves in this society, and really not having a safe space to exist in. You know, it's really hard when you have multiple identities and the one space where you should feel the most comfortable, you are estranged from. So this hashtag and this movement has really lit a fire for so many. And, you know, their voices and their work and their contributions are grossly dismissed and sometimes even appropriated, you know, for others' gains and not getting the credit that they need. So for me, you know, seeing that kind of call out culture, you know, in a rightful way, you know, to address the issue has been, you know, so good to see, because I know that's what motivated me to create Reparative Voice 4 years ago with the lack of visibility of Black disabled women. I'm proud to know, you know, many Black disabled women 4 years later, but it's still, we still need to increase those numbers of visibility for Black disabled women and other women of color and other disabled people of color in the movement. Well, I met some great people since I've been online consistently, probably about 5 years now, but particularly in the past year and a half, just been able to connect with a lot of people and do some great partnerships and just interactions. So it's been great to use that medium to really meet like-minded people and have a nice network and friendships.
I'm super grateful for the internet and social media.
I know people have their own opinions about it, but to me, that's the main perk, is getting to know folks through it.
Yeah, I hear people say, oh, if you spend your time online, you know, that's not real friendships. That's not real connection. And I just really disagree.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because I know for some people, their online relationships are, you know, their most close-knit interactions. For some people, the friends they make online are the only friends they have. So social media has really, in some ways, been life-changing for certain people. I think online friendships can be just as deep, if not deeper, than in real life or, you know, people that you know in your everyday.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. You wrote on RampYourVoice.com about how the hashtag Disability2White actually grew beyond social media and people are putting it in their work offline.
I have an advocate friend who does work in Pittsburgh. His name is Dustin Gibson. I know he always tells me about when he goes to workshops, there's a saying that hashtags are the new protest signs. And he always brings up the different hashtags that the community uses, such as my hashtag, CryptoVote, Disability Solidarity, CryptTax, and so on and so forth. You know, and how these hashtags really speak on the issues, you know, that exist in our community or in, you know, the broader society. So to really see people take my hashtag into these spaces that may be, you know, all white or maybe disabled, but all white or predominantly white or non-disabled spaces, you know, and really discuss why this hashtag and the other hashtags, you know, are impactful to the movement. You know, that's really, you know, a humbling thing. You know, I really like the fact that people are taking it and, you know, putting it to their work. And, you know, they're talking about racism or ableism and connecting how disabled people want their stories to be heard and respected. To use that as one of the examples, you know, given, you know, has been great to hear. In April, I went to the National Association of Black Social Workers Conference that happened in Maryland. And I talked about the hashtag there, and I related it to how Black social workers can become better supporters to Black disabled people. And the target population I used for that presentation was Black disabled women. So be able to talk about what goes on in the disabled community to a group of people that, you know, understand disability from a very medical model standpoint or what they learned through their programs, and to humanize it and to give a different take on it that's more appropriate to how the community wants them to understand disability.
Well, I'm really excited that you are celebrating your hashtagversary with us. That's really awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very excited too.
Activist Karima Sevik wrote an article recently on NOS Magazine where she writes, quote, "I've been on a journey to bring disabled African-American history into the light by reclaiming the disabled identities of history makers," end quote. This article is specifically about Nina Simone, her neurodivergence, and the ableist ways we either erase her experience or victimize her. We'll celebrate her achievements now with a little bit of Feeling Good from Nina Simone, released in 1965 on the I Put a Spell on You album.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
dragonfly out in the sun. You know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun. You know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done. That's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me.
You listed some other hashtags a moment ago, but you also have this series on Ramp Your Voice that's Black Disabled Girl Magic. Because of your firsthand life experiences, you can create this platform for other mm-hmm. Black disabled women to speak and write so honestly and so openly that really deserves a lot of praise and recognition for that space that you're creating.
I did it for Women's History Month, and I wanted to do something different for that month, and I felt that that series was the most appropriate thing to do, and it was so enriching. You know, those five women, you know, gave so much of themselves in their interviews. You have women of different ages, you know, disabilities, you know, location-wise, different backgrounds, you know, and to have them, you know, tell their story, you know, about who they are and, you know, how they came to be in their particular work and the challenges of being, you know, triple jeopardy minority, and the words that of encouragement they have to give to other Black disabled women, you know, just having them give so much of themselves for that series were just amazing. And it really gets me excited to do more of that. And then for Black History Month, I covered some disability leaders at the beginning of the independent living movement that don't really get the recognition that they deserve. These are mainly people who have, you know, passed away, you know, over the years, but to really shine a light on the contributions that they've given to the independent living movement and the collective disability rights movement, you know, is something that I really enjoy doing. Giving space to those stories to be told, you know, is very important to the work that I do. I guess in some ways, I guess I am a storyteller, you know, giving people space or telling the stories of lives lived, but it's really one of the most rewarding things that I do on the blog and in my work is giving that platform to those voices. Because I always tell people that, you know, this work is bigger than myself. So when I do interviews like Disabled Black Girl Magic, you know, it really reminds me of that. You know, this work, you know, means so much, not just to me, but to so many others.
Yes, definitely. You're working on a new project, which we won't go into because it's in the planning phases. It's a new project, again, very directly bringing up intersectionality in the disability community. And so this is a bit of a departure from celebrating Black Disabled Girl Magic, which is... You talk about the need for disabled whites to be equipped in addressing and fighting against racism. And this is language from your blog. Using their privileges and being better accomplices and co-conspirators and allies to disabled people of color. I generally find white people getting very comfortable with the term ally, especially if we get to give it to ourselves. but I don't really hear white people using terms like accomplice or co-conspirator the way that I have heard other people of color and indigenous people use those terms. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about the difference.
Well, for me, I've gravitated towards using accomplices and co-conspirators because ally, you know, has become to me a loaded word. You know, a lot of people don't know what it is. A lot of people don't know how to be it. And a lot of people don't know how to use the privileges that they should be using to be allies, you know, for the cause. And I feel that, you know, as somebody who's, you know, multiple marginalized, but also have certain privileges, I don't give myself the word ally. You know, that's not a title that I need to give myself. It's not a title I should look to receive from other oppressed groups whom I need to work, you know, alongside, you know, to fight whatever isms or phobias that, you know, is harming them and, you know, collectively harming and doing us all an injustice. So, you know, I really feel that if you're going to do the work that's needed to get rid of white supremacy, racism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, just do the work. You don't need a title. Why do you need a title? Why are you making it about you? You know, so, and that's what I feel like a lot of people are making it about them when they call themselves an ally. Like, you're losing sight of what you need to be doing. You need to be using your privileges. You need to be using your voice, giving space, creating space, sometimes moving out the way so that people can have space. Nobody needs to give you a cookie. You know, and I tell people all the time, you know, some whites who come up to me and be like, oh, I did so-and-so. I'm like, well, I'm not going to give you a cookie for doing X, Y, Z. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. Right, so right. What do you want from me? You know, you know, I appreciate you doing X, Y, Z, but I'm not going to give you a gold star for that. Just do the work. You know, with some whites, I feel like they care more about the accolades instead of what needs to be done. This work is hard. This work is dangerous. And if you're not serious about it, you can put people in real danger, you know, and not just, you know, online with being harmful, but also in real life. You know, I really wish that in this case, whites would just, and disabled whites would just do what's needed so that we won't need hashtags like disability to white, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, you know, so that we won't elect officials who have backgrounds that are oppressive and put them in positions where they can have power to oppress further. You know, so just really do what's needed so that we are all liberated and free and experience this world, you know, in the means and the ways that we all should have the opportunity to. So, you know, for whites, you know, stop looking for praise for doing what you should be doing. You know, it's really frustrating, you know, when you find people who care more about that title and not about, you know, earning the respect of people of color. I know there's white disabled advocates who I genuinely respect, who I know have my back, and it's because they've earned it and they put in the work and they're not looking for a thumbs up. They just do what's needed. And for me, that's the type of people that I need by my side, who, when it's time is right, can stand forward and use their privileges, you know, to open doors and give opportunities and to speak up and to confront people who are being harmful. At a time, know when to step back and let us shine, let us speak about our experience and not speak over us and not speak for us, and to know how to listen. I think that's a key thing that a lot of quote unquote allies forget, is that being an ally is more about listening than talking. You listen to what is needed and then you go do what is needed. Particularly in the times that we live in, if you call yourself an ally, be the ally, because we need that now more than ever. But don't expect me or other people of color to praise you for doing what you should be doing, you know, when you live in a world and live in a society that favors your existence over mine and other people that may look like me.
Yeah. You mentioned earning the respect of people of color, and then this whole race to get the biggest plate of cookies. I see white people saying, hey, person of color, you need to respect me because I just got uncomfortable for a little bit. The cookie thing.
I know, it's like you're uncomfortable for, you know, that moment, but we're uncomfortable every second. Okay, yeah, it may made you uncomfortable to hear how, you know, you may be part of the problem, or made you uncomfortable to see somebody getting, you know, disrespected. But we live that every day. We live the possibility of being harmed and disrespected every day, just because we exist, not because we've done something, just for being alive and moving about, you know, this racist society. So I think that whites can't afford to be uncomfortable, and you should be uncomfortable. We all should be uncomfortable with knowing that there are groups of people who are being disadvantaged and targeted every day. That should make us all uncomfortable, just that mere fact alone.
Yeah, and if you're not uncomfortable, you're not paying attention, or you're not connecting to the humanity of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Cheryl Green. I'm talking to Vylissa Thompson, a Black disabled woman who's a social worker, speaker, trainer, and founder of Ramp Your Voice, which is a website and also a self-advocacy and empowerment movement for people with disabilities, always providing an intersectional lens. We're going to listen to a bit of Beyoncé's Formation and then jump into talking about some of the issues we see when white-led, non-disabled-led organizations that serve disability community want to diversify the base they serve.
Louisiana, you mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
This is very much related to the ally thing. I think that I see a lot of people who might identify as right wing who are like, yeah, I don't like people of color. This is my country. You see what they're saying because they just come right out and say it. And then you come over on the left where I'm sitting, everybody's all unity message and nice, and I don't see color and I don't see disability. You're too smart to be disabled and all of these things that are part of the erasure and the silencing. So I've been talking to some people recently at a not surprisingly, white-led, non-disabled-led disability organization. I don't even have to say the name because most of them are white and non-disabled-led.
Right. We'd be here all night trying to figure out exactly which one.
So this particular organization, they have been talking about, we need to serve a more diverse base. We are mostly serving only white people. We need to diversify. But what I don't hear them saying is we need to have more diverse leadership. One of us needs to get off the payroll. We need an advisory board. Actually, you shouldn't have an advisory board. You should be paying people. But I don't hear this piece about diverse leadership. So you want to stay white, non-disabled led and diversify your base. And this is like, some people are still super confused about the conflict here. So can you enlighten us?
Well, first off, you know, when the right wing talk about my country, they need to realize that this is not anybody's country. It's some native indigenous people. So that's something I need to say up front before I get into this. So there is no such thing as my land if you are a white person in America. This is not your land. And it always, you know, boggles my mind when that rhetoric is said. It's like, no, you obviously don't know history. You obviously was not paying attention in history class to understand how this country was built. But that type of mentality, though, of this is my land, you know, can translate into this is my organization, and this is how I want my organization to look like, and I want my organization to look like me. But I also know about this new buzzword called diversity. I want to be diverse, but not really diverse. The leadership is white, and sometimes white and male, heterosexual, cisgender, upper middle class, you know, so you have classism and, you know, of things of that nature. You know, you cannot say you want to be diverse, but not giving opportunities to allow disabled people to lead these, allow disabled people of color or just people of color in general to lead these organizations, you know, to be a part of every level of organization, from the executive director to the board of directors to the advisory board, you know, to the staff, to the volunteers, and then to your client base. And so it's needing to reshape the work culture and really the organizational culture that currently exists to be truly diverse. You know, you have white leadership that wants to tokenize certain voices, you know, and that's a problem that I know that a lot of advocates have in being tokenized by these organizations, both disabled and non-disabled, as being that, oh, we got three people of color, oh, we're diverse now, yay. And then, no, you're not diverse. You know, you're tokenizing people to come into a space to where you wanted them to talk about what you feel is appropriate and not what needs to be discussed. So you're still controlling the message. You're still controlling how diverse you truly become, because you're feeling threatened about, oh, we allow too many in, then that's going to disrupt, or, you know, what we're doing or cause competition. And it's not that way at all. It's giving space, providing space, sometimes removing yourself so that space can be established for underrepresented voices, opinions to be heard, and for people to really see themselves. Because with a lot of these organizations, particularly in the nonprofit sector, you have individuals going out into communities where nobody on the staff looks like the community. And that includes race, that includes, you know, disability and other identifiers. So how can you truly say you want to target a particular base if you don't have people that look like that base? How are you going to really hone in on the issues and the disparities and provide the appropriate resources and supports that they need that's aligned with your mission if you don't know intimately from a authoritative knowledge standpoint of what those challenges are that need to be assisted with? So really, when I hear a lot of organizations that said, oh, we want to be diverse, I roll my eyes, because you really, most of the time, they're really not trying to be diverse. They just want to get, you know, in their own way, organizational cookie to of looking diverse, but really nothing within the organization is changing. You're not giving opportunities. You're not creating space. You're not giving space. You're not really doing the work that's needed to be an intersectional organization to where you are really, you know, targeting a base that you want to assist with, but also within your organization, changing the dynamic of the culture that has existed for so long that is truly not working for you anymore. So, you know, it's really frustrating when you have organizations like what you were talking about that says one thing, but halfway do another. It's a phase, you know, it's a trend, you know, as with any trend, you know, it fades out at some point. And I really feel that the whole diversity trend is greatly disadvantaging those of us who are already, you know, at the margins to not really get within the spaces that we need to be in. So I really, you know, am a very, you know, upset with organizations who are not truly adamant and truly genuine about creating that diversity that is needed. Because when you're not diverse, you're doing yourself a disservice. And you're doing the persons, you know, or community that you serve or are in a greater disservice as well.
I think that first step is getting people to see that contradiction. Mm-hmm. And like you said before, get used to getting uncomfortable. Yeah, so it's a many-stepped process, but you are laying out some of the steps. So, fellow white mm-hmm. listeners, listen to this episode again.
A lot of these organizations, they're not willing to hear, you know, what needs to be done, because, you know, basically when you're told you're part of the problem, that's a very harsh image to have of yourself. So there is a very firm resistance to having that mirror held up to you, because it's basically telling you that you're part of the problem. Even though you have quote unquote good intentions, you are the problem that needs to be fixed. So, you know, I think that a lot of that resistance comes into, you know, realizing that the way you've been functioning has been dysfunctional this whole time. And you're going to have to make changes. And it goes back to being uncomfortable and not really want to deal with those type of emotions and the changes that are needed. And people get set in their ways. You know, organizations get set in their routine of how they do things. And to, you know, shake things up dramatically, you know, can be unsettling for many within an organization.
Yeah. I do want to talk about another piece of like really empowering work that you're doing, your Black Disabled Women's Syllabus. And I am so excited. I see it being shared on Twitter like over and over and over. Talk about your process in putting together the Black Disabled Women's Syllabus.
Okay, well, that was a reaction to always receiving emails or inbox messages from white disabled people wanting to know, you know, why do the experiences of disabled people of color matter, or Black disabled women matter? And I am not the type to do labor for free, you know, particularly when the information is out there for you to access for free, you know, especially we have, you know, for those who, you know, are able to access the internet, we have Google that we can use to search for things. And it just really blew my mind at how, I hate to use the word lazy, but how lazy some white people are in educating themselves, you know, why intersectionality and intersect identities need to be learned about, or people who are multiple marginalized need to give space to share their experiences. So it really created out of frustration of being bombarded with questions all the time in the work that I do. And so I felt like, why not create this resource? And I'm a social worker. Part of social work is providing resources to clients, communities. So it was kind of me putting on my social worker hat and developing this tool that compiles information for people to read on their own and to educate themselves. I believe in self-education. You know, education doesn't always have to take place in the classroom. I know some of the most, you know, brilliant people that I know didn't finish school. I know some of the things that I've learned about, you know, that has made me a better advocate, and I did not learn, you know, in undergrad or grad school. So I believe, you know, self-education and accessing information online, you know, is the future. For me, I wanted to create something that, you know, is a living document. You know, I add to it, you know, every so often with great articles and information that pertain to the Black disabled experience in general, and then breaking it down to Black disabled women and what it's like to be a Black woman and what it's like to be a Black woman with a disability. I am very proud of the fact that it has been, you know, widely shared, as you stated, and used in academia spaces, and you know, just by anyone who really wants to understand a perspective from the words of those people who have those identities. You know, you pick a couple of readings and then you go from there. You know, as somebody who has multiple identities, marginalized identities, it's not my job to educate you on my experiences. I know I take it upon myself to be educated on experiences that are outside of my own, and to not solely rely on handholding of those individuals with those particular identities that I'm unfamiliar with. And that's just something I've always been, you know, do naturally, but particularly as an advocate, I take it upon myself to do that educating so that I won't have to force anybody else to do that labor that they should not have to be asked to do.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine it's also really validating and exciting for, say, another Black disabled woman to find your syllabus and see herself or their selves in those articles. So Yeah, and then I like to share them too. So I'll share the individual articles or posts after I've read them.
Yeah, and I love that too. I love that, you know, there's a syllabus that's particularly for my identity. And, you know, when I find Black disabled women who find the syllabus and they read articles written about either their disabilities or just being a Black disabled woman, that's empowering. You know, that's a very validating understanding that you're not alone. That, and I think that sometimes we don't see ourselves, you know, widely in the media or in the community. You know, we feel very isolated. We feel very other. So coming across, you know, things like the syllabus or coming across the series, you know, the Black Disabled Girl Magic, you know, you reading stories and perspectives that you can relate to, you know, it really shows you that you matter. You matter to the point to where your identity has a place. Your identity is real. You have a community of other Black disabled people and then Black disabled women whom you have this connection to. And I think that for many of us, we do not see ourselves to really feel that type of connection. So to really have this way to connect with each other by reading these stories and books and, you know, seeing video and, you know, so on and so forth, you know, just really shows people that, you know, they have value. And that is something that, you know, is priceless for somebody to experience, you know, whether they're a teenager, whether they're a young adult, whether they're an older person, to realize that you have value in this world that tells you otherwise is so important to receive.
Yeah. Yeah. You are doing labor, but at least you're not doing it individually for every single email that says, why does this matter? So yes. Thank goodness.
I don't mind doing just like this type of labor to where it's widely received and people can get what they need from it.
Yeah. Are there any people who you especially want to name, you want us to know about and find online and follow too?
Oh, yes. I'm a part of the Harriet Tubman Collective, which is a group of Black disabled advocates. We formed together almost, it'd be a year this summer. And we, you know, come from different backgrounds, different ages, different disability types. And we discuss the disabled experience, you know, from this intersectional lens. I know we've put out two statements that target either racism or, you know, the ignorance surrounding Black disability identity within the Black community. We do some great work individually, and when we come together and write about statements that we feel that we need to address, you know, when something's come about in the community or in other social justice spaces. So I'm very proud to be a part of that. And within that group, we have advocates such as Heather Watkins, who was one of the women that I featured for the Black Disabled Girl Magic series, along with Carrie Gray, who was also featured for that series. We have T.L. Lewis, who does incredible work with their organization called HEARD that focuses on the experience of deaf, hard of hearing individuals, and they're a lawyer, and they do a lot of work, you know, when it comes to the legal aspect and talking about prisons and mass incarceration and police brutality. Their work is just phenomenal and so needed, particularly now, you know, in the times where, you know, police brutality and, you know, imprisonment, you know, are topics that we need to be discussing. And also the gentleman that I mentioned, Dustin Gibson, who does a lot of community involvement work in Pittsburgh. It's just so many of us that's really doing great things. And outside of the collective, there's Kia Brown, who's a journalist and a writer who was also featured in that particular series. But there's, of course, Alice Wong with the Disability Visibility Project, as well as Crick the Vote. She does great work. One of my favorite people that I've really gotten to know. There's Lydia Brown, who's a lawyer, and they do great work when it comes to bringing awareness about the plight of autistic individuals. just great work being done out there from so many people in this community. And those are just a small handful that I've mentioned, but they've, you know, just really amazed me. And I'm so fortunate to have the support and to know them and to call them friends and, you know, fellow advocates. We have a great number of folks just doing incredible work out here, whether they're just mainly online, whether they're on Twitter, or tweeting, doing threads, or they're out in the community, whether they're putting their, you know, very bodies on the line for justice and freedom and liberation, whether they're working with young adults, you know, who, you know, particularly those, you know, coming on our heels as millennials, you know, in this movement, whether they're, you know, working to reshape these organizations that, you know, are overdue to be put on notice. You know, just, they're just really, you know, doing this dynamic work and really reshaping the movement to where it should be. So I am very proud to be a part of the movement in this moment, to know so many dynamic voices who are just amazing and who I respect deeply and who I support 100%. Those are just some great people that I've been very blessed to know.
For anyone who's listening instead of reading the transcript, all of those names will be linked in the transcript. So check out the transcript. Would you please tell us again where people can find you online?
Of course, the website, which is rampyourvoice.com. You can find me on Facebook at Ramp Your Voice. I have a Facebook page for that and also a public page with my name, Violissa Thompson. You can find me on Twitter at Violissa Thompson and then at Ramp Your Voice. I'm mostly on Twitter, mainly on my personal page, where you see me interacting with other advocates, interacting with other Black women who are trailblazers in their own work, and they're really talking about the issues that matter to me, and also having a little fun too, being a little nerdy here and there. We're talking about some of the things that I'm interested in on a personal level. But you'll definitely get to see my personality and my passions if you follow me online. I can also be reached by email at violissa@rampyourvoice.com. You can reach me there to just tell me what your thoughts about this interview or wanting to know more about the services and that I provide, which are speaking, presenting and consulting, and also writing. I cover topics such as intersectionality, obviously, discussing politics, education, you know, being a triple jeopardy minority, as a social worker, talking about social work and disability, and just a whole other host of topics that I have become an expert in and am willing to share with interested organizations, individuals, and spaces that want to learn about the disabled experience from a very intersectional lens. So that's kind of what I do, and been doing it for 4 years, and don't see myself stopping at any time soon. I love what I do. This is definitely my life's passion, and I'm glad to be doing work that, you know, brings me joy.
And doing it relentlessly.
Yes, yes. I'm very passionate about this work. I'm very protective of this work because I know that it is greatly needed. And I'm very blessed to have the ability to do it in a way that enriches the lives of other people. To me, that's the greatest responsibility we can have, is when we impact other people and we leave this lasting effect that, you know, changes lives, you know, in ways that we see and in ways that we don't see. So I'm just very fortunate to really discuss, you know, what makes, as my grad teacher would say, what makes my heart sing, which I think has really driven me to really create a space and a career and advocacy path that aligns with my purpose and who I am as a person.
You have been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Many thanks again to our engineer, Tom. We always welcome new collective members, and if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org or reach out to us at breadandroses@kboo.org. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses, and we are on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio. We're going to go out listening to the 1991 track Optimistic by Sounds of Blackness. Have a good night, everyone.